when we were much earlier, everyone was a generalist, and that's the kind of individual contributor generalist that you needed. And as you grew and grew and grew, obviously you need different types of people, more specialists, more managers. You need to build in more layers. And so the type of company changes as well.
Hey, this is Gareth Webb, and you're listening to Breakout, a show that cuts through the hiring noise. Here, you'll get an unfiltered view on what early and growth stage companies are doing so that you can take their best practices, processes, and frameworks and implement them to help you build teams more confidently. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us today. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself and your background and a bit about your business?
Sure, happy to. And Gareth, thanks for having me on today. So I've worked at a healthcare technology firm called Iterative Health for the past 4.5 years now, where Iterative Health is a company that brings computer vision and AI technologies into the gastro space. And so during that time that I've been here, the company has gone from 10 employees when I joined to now over 160 employees. And
okay,
start at a company that small with that few employees, everyone's a generalist. So when I joined, my responsibilities range from managing the finance and accounting teams to the HR operations and the recruiting teams to even the legal and compliance and regulatory work. And as the company has grown, I've been fortunate enough to have grown in those roles for the company. And so we're kind of still looking at finance, looking at HR recruiting, looking at legal, and helping to manage that for the business going forward. My prior life was more in the... Oh,
yeah. No, I was going to say, when you joined, what was your title when you joined the business?
When I joined, my title was a director of finance and operations. Okay. Now I've gone up to a VP of finance and operations.
Okay, very good. And from 10 to 160 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And in a prior life, I was more working on the investment side, working with a private equity firm, doing some investments in the healthcare space, but decided I wanted to change of pace and want to be inside a company, see how that was. So that's why I made the switch.
Did the change of pace happen? Did you feel it?
The work is certainly different, and the challenges I'm working on are certainly different. So different problems, but I would say in terms of the amount of work that you're putting in, working at a fast growing startup and working in a busy PE firm is very, very similar in terms of the amount of work that you have to put in. As yep. I'm sure it's the same for you as well as you're running your company.
Yeah, and it's just like there's no end to the work, right? I think, right. And work creates work. What drew you to Iterative specifically? How did that all happen? How did you land there?
Yeah, so there's a few things that kind of drew me there. One was I was very impressed with the kind of progress that they had made, even with it as a very small company. They had already had relationships with some of the best known kind of research institutions, some really high profile advisors there that raised some money, but also with the mission that the company had, which was to use the technology that they built and are building to help reduce healthcare disparities over time. And the last part, which was really important as well, is I knew the founder from business school and I knew him. And because of that, when he talked to me about this opportunity, and I've worked with him before, I've not in a professional setting, but I also know him socially, and decided this might be a good foray into switching my track.
Just to take a step back, if you don't mind, because I think you've sort of said something which a lot of people that really listen to this would be interested in, is you mentioned, like, said going to business school, right, and getting your MBA. First of all, what was the reasoning to do that? Because there's a big debate in our world, whether it's VCs, PEs, startups, scale-ups, enterprise customers. Some people love it, some people don't love it so much, and there seems to be like not much middle ground. Like, what was the decision from your side to go and do that? What was the kind of genesis for it?
Yeah. So I personally loved it. I think I would recommend business school to most people, but you have to know what you're looking for and what you're trying to get out of it. And so I would say if you're looking at business school, there's some people, of course, who are going in there for a 2-year vacation, right? They just want to go and take a break from work and still be able to come out of it. That's that if you have the resources and if your company's funding you and all that, that's not a bad way to go. But I think it really is two main important benefits that I found. And one is it really gives you 2 years to do whatever you want. And if it fails, it fails. And you can still come back out very viable for the job market. And so I see a lot of people, especially on the startup side, go into business school and spend those 2 years working really hard trying to make their company or their idea or meet co-founders and work together on something that to succeed. And when you're in school and you're a student and you want to talk to all these different experts, they're much more willing to talk to you than if you were just an entrepreneur working on a business. And so that's one of the benefits, especially on the entrepreneurship side, is that it just gives you 2 years of time that doesn't really hurt you if you fail. The second thing is if you're, there's actually three. The second thing is actually more on the networking side. You meet a lot of people that you might not necessarily meet at your job. As we work in our careers, you're working with the similar people and you're broadening your network somewhat, but there's less of an opportunity to meet so many different people in an MBA program, right? And so if you're looking for a co-founder, that's something that you can find more easily in business school. If down the road, you're looking for other jobs, you now have a lot of people in your network that are in a similar position as you, that have grown in different careers as you have, and they may know open positions in their company that, you know, when you're hiring for people, referrals and networking is one of the best ways to get hired for more and more senior positions. And the last one is if you don't have experience in business or you want to transition from one job to another. So if you want to move from, let's say, being a product manager to working in the VC or the PE space, or you know, vice versa, or any of those big changes, you can do that much more easily through business school than trying to do it yourself during your career.
Yeah, I think they're really good points. So basically summarizing that there's not really downside. Like if you have a bigger goal of setting a business up or finding a co-founder to think about starting a business with, it's a good thing to do. If that doesn't happen, you're highly marketable anyway to certain parts of the commercial world. Building the network out and then pivoting, like as you did, right, from finance and investing into operating.
Right, exactly. I would say the downside is that it costs a lot of money to go into it, and if you don't know what you want out of it, you're not going to get much out of it. So
yeah, and the cost is what, like, it's, you're talking, yeah, if you're going to a good top 20, top 10 school, it's yeah, like $250,000.
Yeah, I would say if you add in the living cost and everything else, then and not making the income, yeah, it's easily, can easily be in that range of $250,000.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about that. It's worked out well for you so far. So I think that's very, you know, look, I think one of the things we see, right, is it's a good indicator of self-investment and it's a good indicator of someone's thinking longer term. I think that the bit where it doesn't make sense to me personally, and people may not agree with me on this note, is like going to do it at an average school probably isn't worth it. Like I think even if it costs 100, like it's probably best to try and do it at a top 10, 20 place, even if it's going to cost you twice the amount. That should probably pay for itself over time. That's based on the experience I have and see in the conversations that we have with people. So yeah, I think they're very interesting points. So going back to Iterative Health, can you talk a little bit more about the product and the technology? Because I think it's super interesting. We do a lot of work with health tech companies, AI, computer vision. Can you talk a little bit about the IP?
Sure. Yeah, there's two products that we're primarily working on. And one is a medical device that's been cleared by the FDA. What it does is it helps gastroenterologists when they're performing a colonoscopy, and a colonoscopy is used mostly as a screening for colorectal cancer. And so when they're performing this, to be able to detect and find adenomatous polyps. And so it helps call attention to areas where it may be of areas of concern. So while they're doing the colonoscopy and there's a camera inside the patient's body, and usually that camera goes directly to a monitor where the GI is looking for these areas. Our product sits in between the computer, the monitor, and the camera, and it uses an AI computer vision algorithm to, in real time, draw boxes around areas of concern so that the doctors can look more closely. And if they can find more of these adenomas polyps, that research has shown that that reduces the risk of cancer for the patient. So that's one product that we're working on and that we recently got FDA clearance on. The second thing that we're working on is building out technologies that can help help improve the research and development for life science companies. So this is more in the inflammatory bowel disease space, but we have a variety of algorithms that help speed up the research and development process to building new drugs, whether that be trying to find and identify patients that can work fit into the clinical trials that they're running, or whether it be building out tools and technologies that can help them measure more accurately how much improvement their drugs are having or how much of an impact they're having on different patients.
So one is like a hardware piece with software within it, and the second is more software. Yeah, very good. Okay, so how's the business changed from when you joined? Like you mentioned, the headcount changed.
Yeah, it's changed quite a lot, and I see it in the stages of the business that we were in, and I would say that what I think about the business, I see it as when we were less than 30 employees, that was one type of business. And then when you go from 30 to 75 or maybe 100 employees, that's another type of business altogether. And then 150 plus it becomes a separate type of another. Again, it changes in terms of what you need and the type of business and everything else, right? And so I would say that when we were much earlier, everyone was a generalist, and that's the kind of individual contributor generalist that you needed. And as you grew, obviously you need different types of people, more specialists, more managers. You need to build in more layers. And so the type of company changes as well. And there's so many parts of it, the culture, how that affects the company, how you execute, how you communicate, all change as the company grows. And I'm sure like once you get to the 500 and 1,000 plus employee ranges, that changes again.
Yeah. Have you had much like C-level exec changes in that time?
We've had quite a bit of changes within the company. And I think it's a function of the way the company grows. I've been lucky enough to stay in on the executive team as the company has grown. But I would say that in my time, I feel like there's been two or three different runs of people that have come and joined as leaders and then have left as well. So and they correlate approximately to, I would say, as we're growing from the 10 to 80 person mark to the 80 to 150 person mark. But
okay,
it depends on sometimes if they were looking for, we were the right company for them, if they were the right employees for us. And sometimes it's just kind of natural changes because not everyone stays around in the company for 4 or 5 years now at this rate.
Yeah, it's a long time for startup land. You know, a lot of people are on certain like 3, 4, 5 year vesting schedules and they don't want to stick around for longer than that, which I think that's a whole different conversation probably. Right. But I think you're right. Having organizations scale to certain points, become entirely different entities, and just by nature of communications. And are you a fully remote team?
We're hybrid right now. So we have offices in Boston, New York, and Dallas, Texas. And so there's, I would say about 40% of our employees are outside of those areas and they're fully remote. But for the people who are in those metropolitan areas, we're in the hybrid position coming in 2 days a week.
Okay. So one of the things you said that's really interesting, right, is this basically like everybody's generalist within the realm of what's realistic, right? So I guess like product and eng R&D folks kind of stay there. Maybe they help with some other stuff, but for somebody like yourself, where it's finance and ops, you are probably doing like, as you said, 5, 6 things, which is finance, ops, people, some strategy, potentially fundraising efforts, stuff like that. Like at what point have you guys experienced that the need to change from that to more like functional expertise? At what point has that kicked in for you?
Yeah, I would say it's as the company grows, we've had to make these changes pretty quickly since we grew really quickly. But in general, I would say that, you know, if you read the business books and you hear people talk, you hear about the fact that you need, you know, you can only manage 7 people directly over time, right? And so you start needing not only individual contributors and people who can do stuff, but you start needing managers pretty quickly. In the beginning, you might be the founder and you have the vision, you're working with all the individual contributors to execute. But generally speaking, once you have one of the 7 direct reports, they start taking up more and more and more of your time. So that's when you need the managers. And managers in the beginning are actually just, at least the way we did it, was more high powered and more experienced individual contributors. Because you can have those people, even if they've never had management experience, they're generally very capable of leading teams of 3, 4 individual contributors, right? And you can rely on their expertise and you can rely on them to help you execute. But then as you grow even further, let's say past the 50, 70 employee mark, that's when you need managers and managers. And that gets really tricky on who you're hiring or what type of managers you're hiring. And that's when, if you hire the right people, they will do, the company will have great communication, great like alignment on vision, and great execution. But if you hire the wrong people, that's when you can get the breakdowns of communication in terms of strategy and in terms of everything else.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing more expensive than getting that wrong, right? And not right. Just the monetary, but just culturally and time and having to rebuild things. What have you learned as like, would you say, just for people listening in, to key mistakes that you personally, like, you know, if you're prepared to share, like, what have you looked back on the 5 years with Iterative? Like, what would you say have been the kind of mistakes or learning points that you've gone through in terms of hiring folks at the wrong level at the wrong time type thing?
Yeah, there's been a lot of good lessons learned, I would say that. So I'll touch upon a few and then we can dive deeper into any of them that you think would be interesting to the listeners.
Yes.
But one of the first ones was making, I would say, I don't think these are all mistakes because we're here at where we are as a company. And I think
the nature of the beast. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the nature of the beast. But I would say deciding to hire quickly and really hiring very rapidly is a decision that you shouldn't take too lightly. There's a lot of things that come with hiring a lot of people very quickly. And I can talk to you about that. But maybe in another company or in another life, I may have hired a little bit slower, let things play out, have the team stretch themselves a bit more as we build out the team, right? So that's one of them. Okay. The second one is on communications. I can't emphasize how important the communication side is, where you're used to, when you're with a 30-person, a 50-person team, you can say something a few times and everyone gets it and everyone's aligned. The more people that you have, and it's like a game of telephone, right? You talk to the people who are directly working with you. They talk to the people who are directly working with them. And it becomes a pendulum of what one thing that you say can get magnified as it gets down to the people who are like at the individual contributors and the doers at the grassroots of the company. And so that gets being very thoughtful and spending a lot more time making sure that communication is flowing correctly for the company would be another big one for me. And kind of just the nature of the work that you have to do. And that would be my last one is, in the beginning, you're, to be effective and to be successful, you work hard, you do things, right? You're executing. And over time, it becomes much more about ensuring alignment, getting buy-in, making sure other people understand the vision, making sure everyone understands the strategy, and making use of your time effectively, where it may feel good to do certain things yourself and execute, but in reality, the work that you do can be magnified if you're spending it on other areas that you're not as familiar with yet.
Yeah, they're all 3 very good points, actually. I think The first one is very timely with what we've experienced in the last year and a half since May 2022. So not hiring as much, stretching people, and then adding, like when there's literally no more capacity for execution within that team. And I think, unfortunately, like that is the way it is now. And I think it's going to stay that way. But obviously at the tail end of before the pandemic and then post-pandemic in the low interest rate environment, it just wasn't a thing to do that. It meant you probably weren't being ambitious enough or scaling fast enough. But there's plenty of good examples of people that did do that and were disciplined and had very good outcomes without going mad on headcount and raising. So I think that's, we've got very good case studies of companies that are now in that mode, but like they weren't in that mode before, and they're probably performing better now, on a relative basis anyway, in terms of, you know, turnover and EBITDA. And then I think the other pieces make a ton of sense as well. Like, I just think, you know, how do you, the more you bring people in, the more you create more noise, potentially, as you said, comms has to be really well aligned. And then the whole piece of scaling yourself out as an executive gets talked about quite a lot, but like letting go and having good enough processes so that like delegation actually works. Do you or any of the execs, any of the other kind of senior folks at the business, do you have a chief of staff type person, or does that exist in the business?
We do. And yeah, having a good chief of staff is really helpful for the business. I would say communications in terms of just organization, trying to keeping, you know, a chief of staff can mean a lot of different things to different. So, yeah. And I'm sure the role of chief of staff in our position, our company might be very different, but I would say focusing on some of the communication aspects, making sure that they are clued into what's happening on the ground, being able to identify and proactively react to problems are some of the things that really help on our side with the phenomenal chief of staff that we have.
Do you have one across the leadership team? Do you?
We have one that reports directly to the CEO. Other executives and some of the leadership team as well have kind of EAs that help them with certain administrative stuff, but that's a different type of role, I would say.
Yeah. So we've seen I would say as a rise of that chief of staff from, I think, the earliest companies to probably do it, obviously outside of like political organizations, is like Microsoft, Google, mm-hmm. but it's gone right down now to Series A. Like, I think, you know, we've seen a proliferation of that skill set, whether it's a very smart graduate that's got a couple of years of experience out of school, post MBA, potentially more senior. But I think, I think what it does is help that third point you mentioned about like making sure that there's you're scaling yourself and the work and the communications downward to become more effective as a business. Like, the chief of staff is super interesting. Yeah, I was just curious as to whether you guys had that and how you kind of felt that influencing business. I think a lot of places we're talking to at the moment are like, who don't have that. They're thinking about it earlier and earlier.
Yeah, one last point on that is also,
no, go for it.
It helps with prioritization, because when you're in a startup, and Gareth, you asked me this earlier on and how it was different working in a private equity firm versus working at a startup. I think one of the things that is different is you have pretty set deadlines when you're working in an investment firm, whereas in a startup, you have not necessarily a lot more, you have a lot less deadlines and everything's a fire. You decide how much you want to prioritize. And so if you're the CEO or if you're an executive and you have all these different priorities, I've seen successful chief of staffs to also be able to handle maybe not your top three priorities, but maybe to help handle the other fires that are burning, the fourth fire or the fifth fire, which are still equally important, but you only have 24 hours in a day and hopefully you're sleeping. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a lot of what it comes down to, isn't it, as well? Like being able to sustainably manage the fires that exist every day and park some of, like, sort them out as quickly as possible, but some of them need to be parked. Going back, I don't want to talk too much more about it because you kind of went into some good detail on it, but I would ask the question, like, on that whole prioritization thing, like, if your VP of like finance and ops, pretty much all your work is around prioritization, right? Whether it's spend and time and resource. So where do you think the MBA helped with that? Like specifically any particular techniques or tools or strategies that you've learned there to help you become better at that?
Yeah. I think if you came from a background with no finance and business knowledge, I think there's a lot of frameworks and tools and kind of theories that could help. I would say that nothing beats in-person, on-the-ground, hands-on experience. And so there's always a framework for thinking about how to do capital allocation, which is what you're talking about, right? Like how much we have this amount of resources, what should we invest in to build for future growth? How should we invest in current projects that can bring short-term returns, right? And so, but the frameworks only are helpful to a certain extent. And after that, it's dependent on the situation of the company and the strategy of the company. And so when we think about our goals, right, it's sometimes it's a question of, are we looking to drive revenue growth or are we trying to drive footprint? Is a question that sometimes we will ask. And driving footprint may come at the cost of revenue and come at the cost of money, but will it be sustainable for us in the future to be able to have a larger footprint and then think about revenue generation? Another thing that's always a question that we think about is research and development. How much, as a technology firm, do we invest in research and development? How much can we think about building out tools that may not see immediate, like this year, impact on our financials, but could make us, could be the basis of a product that we launch in the future, or could be the basis of something will make our margins better in the future for one of our product lines.
Super helpful. I think, I think this year we were on a call the other week with a VC that we were talking about trends more in SaaS than in devices and or kind of IoT. But yeah, I was quite shocked how R&D had come down overall in the last year and sales and marketing had gone up. Obviously, everybody's trying to get revenue, but it didn't seem proportionate to me. But again, we're talking about SaaS, so maybe people are just happy to sit tight for a year. Whereas I think with devices and health tech, if you're not pushing R&D envelope a bit harder, then you're probably not going to get funded or you're going to stand out and make any impact. Very interesting. Yeah. So going back to like sort of scaling the team out a bit more with the business, and I think, yeah, we're always looking for tactical advice to give to people who are listening or people that want to kind of like understand what others are doing in this space. What have you guys done well to attract really good top tier senior folks?
Yeah. Well, I would say one of the best ways to attract senior folks is to leverage your network. And for us, it's working with our investors, working with kind of talking to the people that you know in, within the company or that you've worked with in the past, and asking them for referrals from the network is one of the best ways to do it. And that's, then you get people who have references and who are referred over, and they've, you know, a little bit more about what you're getting as a talent pool. But then beyond that, I think it depends on the stage of the business that you're in. I would say, or trying to attract talent early on as a company, you maybe can't afford as much base salary to attract top tier talent. And then that's where the mission becomes really important, that the potential growth of the company becomes very important. Your equity becomes very important. Some companies also offer higher titles, but that's actually something that I would advise against because it leads to title inflation, a lot of pain down the road, especially if you grow more as a company. Once you get into a stage where you're a little bit more established and you have more resources, it could be that you're still competing on the mission and kind of the work that they're doing. But then you can be a little bit more generous with the cash compensation side as well, right? But I would say the things that make us really allow us to attract some of the best talent is people that are working with us, advocating for the company and talking about the company to people in their network. The second thing is just the mission of the company and the ability to work on things that are more on the cutting edge and that they can learn. And so that's how I would say, yeah, the people, the mission, the product is probably important for us.
Yeah. At what point, when have you decided like that the network doesn't cut it and that you haven't been able to sort of constantly find somebody who's known to you all? Like at what point, what mechanisms and decision-making means you bring in some other folks like a search firm or something to do that for you?
Yeah. And part of that question is, do you have an internal recruiting team or not? Right. And when do you, so maybe let me kind of talk about that a bit and then I'll answer your question. But I think
go for it.
If you're hiring as a company, having an internal TA function is huge. They can save you money. They know the roles. They know the context better of the company. Right. But you want to, again, going to that sustainable growth stage, you want to build it in a sustainable manner. You want to have, when you're hiring a lot of people, it's easy to build a huge recruiting team, but you may not have that growth in hiring all the time. Right. So what do you do then? And what you do then is that you either utilize outside support, and maybe you do both, and outside support you can turn on and off as you have a lot more reps for a while and then less so, right? Or you utilize outside support because you need special like niche roles, right? Like you're hiring for a very senior level manager in finance, or you're hiring for a legal person, you might need specialized people who have that experience. The other thing that you can do instead of using outside partners is to use tools and technologies and other things that can make your existing team much more efficient. And so there's all sorts of things that can make your TA team efficient. It just depends on if they know how to use it and how effective it is for them. And you can measure those really easily through metrics, right? So I would say that the network is important, and that's kind of the first place we go for when we look at teams, but it's one part of the solution in combination with, let's say, an internal TA team, the tools that they have to use to make their search and their work more efficient, and then and lend that expertise or just the additional manpower.
Yeah. At what point did you guys bring that team in-house? At what size?
When we realized we were spending so much money paying outside firms, hires. But I would say once we reached a 60 person size, and then we grew really fast to about 100. We almost tripled in size in the span of 9 months. Around that 60 employee size, we made the decision to start hiring an internal TA team.
Yeah. So, okay. And then, so once you basically decide if they have the bandwidth and the capability, then they will do everything. But if they don't have everything set, then you might look externally for certain senior positions. If you're basically 3x-ing a headcount in 9 months, how do you prepare for like bringing those people in and onboarding them successfully? Because that's a huge challenge.
Yeah. And so I would say a lot of people think about this role as something that the people operations or the HR team does. And it's true that a lot of it does go into there. You need to have really defined processes where you just bring in people. They go through training about, they learn more about the company. They learn more about the tools and the skills that they'll use. We have a procedure in place where managers will have, you know, in 30 days, these are your goals. And we have a automatically scheduled meeting to go over your 30 day goals and see if you've succeeded at them. And in 60 days, this is what we're expecting you to do. And 90 days is what we're expecting you to do, and having those meetings confirm that they're on track or not. Which was just really helpful. But the reality is that you need to have very good managers to be able to work and spend enough time with the team to onboard them. The worst part is if you hire 20 employees within the span of a few weeks and only some of them have the time with their managers or the time to work with different parts of the team to get ramped up and to understand what they're driving around. Because then if you don't do that and you don't make sure that you have enough time, enough resources, enough ramp up with their actual teams and not just the HR team, then they're going to be wandering around not knowing what to do, or even worse, doing things that might not actually help the company and cause more confusion.
Yeah. On that note, very briefly, there's a couple of other things I wanted to ask you, but like, how junior have you hired us kind of year or two?
Yeah, we've hired employees that were right out of graduate school. We've hired a few employees right out of even college, but that was much more common as we were a smaller company. And as we've grown, we focused a lot more on building out kind of more specialized positions and more middle level and senior managers.
Yeah, that's happening across the board. We're seeing just like flatter orgs, more leveling up, more experience, just I think with budgets being tighter, companies trying to be leaner and everybody being contributors. Unfortunately, it's probably a tough time if you're straight out of school, but like people just not having the mental bandwidth or the resource to like give those people a chance at onboarding successfully. So it's definitely sounds like it's dropped off. But I was curious with your stage and size, just like one of the final things I wanted to get into, just because it's interesting because you guys are hybrid in nature and you have a few different hubs. What are you doing to, well, this is a big problem for everybody at the moment, especially high growth companies. Some seem to have it down in terms of being remote or hybrid, but hybrid and fully in office is tricky, it seems. What are you guys doing to kind of develop and enhance culture, you know, with that kind of like working model? Maybe what are the learning points that occurred in the last few years, and what are you trying to do not to just sort of like enhance culture? What I mean by that is make it a place where people want to come in to work, people enjoy it, and they get something out of it. Because there's no right or wrong here, right? It's really difficult and it's pleasing everybody is impossible. But if that is the way you're working and you're asking people to come in X times a week, I think it's like, what are you doing to make people buy into that and feel good about it?
Yeah. I think this is a question that a lot of companies are trying to solve for, right? And we don't know if we've made the right, we've gotten the perfect combination yet. And the reason why we like being hybrid is because of the communication aspect, the kind of the in-person interactions. And so mm-hmm. I think the things that we learned is that in the beginning, we thought, hey, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and this is going to make people really excited about coming back into the office. And
yeah,
some of those work really well. So things that we did were we had a really nice office space. We had really good snacks in the office. We're trying to get sometimes offering free lunches, trying to get people to do activities outside of work as well, like just planning some of this. And then also having much more in-person meetings in-person meetings where you can interact and all that. I would say some of those worked really well. Others were less. Well, we started serving our employees that helped understand some of their concerns of coming in, getting their feedback and reacting more directly to some of their feedback was huge. And then we also realized that as we were kind of conducting a lot of these, kind of focusing on the in-person aspect of it, there's still a good chunk of our workforce that is remote. And so moving and offering benefits to the remote employees so that they don't feel siloed from the employees who are kind of near an office and that come in and get you know, all these different benefits was also important for us to think about culture and community as a whole. But in general, yeah. I think the way that you get people to come in is if they enjoy the people that they're working with, and enough of those people are in office and they can have these interactions with these people professional level on a social level, that's when you get people really excited about coming into the office.
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter what the format is, whether it's fully in, which is, I mean, we know like the data just proves that's difficult for people to build a top tier talent pool and scale seamlessly. Hybrid is like, well, what does that mean? 1, 3, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then remote is, you know, remote plus travel or remote plus we're remote, but we do, you know, like quarterly meets and stuff like that. And it's working well. I saw a post this week from one of the executives at Atlassian that was saying that like their prediction was how companies operate is going to be more important than culture. And probably they are similar nowadays, but like what it meant was like the way work gets done, the way decisions get made, the way decisions get communicated down, the way people feel about the mission and seeing their work bled into the product or the mission. She's like, all that stuff is more important than what you do for them in terms of bribes, as people kind of sometimes perceive it, right? Yeah. To come in and we kind of know that. I think it's a lot easier for companies like you who are genuinely building products which that are mission critical to life, not just like, oh, you know, we make roads more efficient, or we can help you gauge how much fuel you're using in your house. Yeah, I think it's like technology that will literally help people's diagnosis. That's something that I guess this is part of how you bring people into the business. If they don't give a shit about that, then they probably should work somewhere else. And so if they do, then they should be cool with coming in a few days a week to sit around a whiteboard and come up with good ideas. And so is that like how the business operates and what the, and relating to the mission is more important than anything? It sounds like you guys are kind of open-minded and thinking things through at the very least.
Yeah, we're trying to be flexible because we realize that the nature of work has been changed a lot since COVID, and the expectations of that has been changing. But you're right, it's all about kind of, do people perceive that coming in is more productive and more beneficial to the organization as they start working? Are they interested in kind of being surrounded working with other people in person, right? Are working towards the same goals? Are they excited about the mission? All that is very key. But the free lunches and the free snacks, of course, doesn't hurt, but it's not as important as we initially thought it would be.
I mean, I previously worked at a company in San Francisco, 2017. I went out there for my onboarding and it was great. Like I spent a week in San Francisco, but I walked into the office and it was huge. And it was hybrid as well, pre-pandemic. People could work from home. I think it was 1 or 2 days a week, whenever they wanted. So I went in on the Monday. Monday was quite busy. I went to the kitchen, like dining area, and it was bigger than our London office. It was like kind of quite obscene to me that they were spending that much money on that. And I think it was over the top for sure, but it's Silicon Valley. So I kind of like, oh, I'd come to expect it. But yeah, I do agree. I think things like that, if people are complaining about stuff like that, they're just going to complain about anything for the most part. Like if you're putting on lunch for people when they come in, I think that's a nice touch. I would kind of want to ask a couple of things before we wrap up, and you're good at putting things into threes. So I'll ask you for the top three points for this. If someone is like an aspiring VP finance, VP finance and ops, like you're VP of both, what do you think people need to do? You know, if they're at an IC level now, they're like an analyst or FP&A, and they want to be a VP of FP&A or finance and ops, what are the three things you think they should be thinking about now, if they're maybe 3, 4, 5 years away?
I would say I'll put it into threes. And so the first thing is find ways to be able to leverage yourself, right? It doesn't matter how hard you work, unless you're able to leverage, whether it be an intern, like more effective tools, more team members, right? Unless you're able to leverage something to maximize your output, it's going to be hard for you to increase your output enough to show more results and to kind of grow as an individual. Because I make the base assumption that you're working really hard already and that you're very capable. And so then you need the next thing. Everyone has the same amount of hours. So it's just how much more efficiently you are using those hours with the right tools, with the right team. to be able to do that. The second thing is, I think, to be comfortable with things that you're not necessarily strong, right? And it's, if you're a really good analyst or you're a really good individual contributor, that means you're really comfortable and you're really good at executing and doing the work. But that might not mean that you're really good at delegating, or you're really good at communicating to a team, or you're not really good at kind of building alignment and consensus and pushing forward decisions. And that's generally, as you get into the middle levels of management, that's where you need to start becoming much more comfortable with it. And part of that, especially as an analyst, is just to start thinking about how you can manage upwards with your, with who you report to, right? And also how you can kind of interact with your peers and colleagues to kind of push decisions forward. And the last thing is to kind of always keep learning. Some people, I feel like, are stuck in just exactly what they know and what they do, but being able to change and to be open to trying new things, to trying new technologies, to keep up to date on the latest things that are changing and hear what other people are using to measure is really important. For example, we touched briefly on this before, but the type of what investors are looking for is different, right? Before, people were more likely to invest in R&D. They're more okay with investors are more okay with having losses for future growth. Now things are changing and investors want high quality revenue that's repeatable, that has good margins, right? And so things always change out on the outside, and you have to be constantly learning and keeping up to date with the industry and be open to trying new things, new metrics, new tools, new processes as well.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I'm doing quite a bit of refocusing on some learning at the moment with my time, and just, yeah, there's a lot of noise out there with AI, for example. So it's like, right, how do you cut out the noise and where do you find the useful stuff? Where do you just talk about, like, and I fully believe you from how you're saying it, like continuously learning, like what are some of the resources, tools, destinations, things that you use for that? Are there any you can recommend?
Yeah. For me, it's much more about kind of talking to advisors, talking to people within the network. And so I always have a ton of people that I can talk to who gives me some of the context. And sometimes it's two or three different experts. So, for example, when I was recruiting, when I was trying to figure out how to build out the recruiting team and how to build out the team in general and put in best practices, when we didn't have an internal TA team, I was talking to advisors who were running, who had in the past built out recruiting teams at Amazon and had managed a global team of over, 100 plus recruiters at AWS, right? And I was asking for their advice. On the finance side, I was talking to different CFOs in the local network. And that's generally how I've been able to scale pretty quickly. But I know websites, some of the professional networking groups, there's local groups for leadership teams, CFOs, there's a few networks that I'm in, and sometimes the peers and have the collaboration, the support from those are really helpful as well. So it depends. There's always a lot of ways to learn, but I found that the person-to-person ones are the most effective for me.
Yeah, it's good. I wasn't actually expecting you to say that, but it does make some sense. I think, yeah, like context and connection experience together is kind of pretty powerful. Well, look, thank you very much. It's been super helpful, Daniel. I really appreciate all your insights, and sounds like you've learned a hell of a lot over the last 4 or 5 years, and I'm really grateful for your time with us.
Yeah, and thank you again for having me on. It was great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Breakout. If you want to hear more, make sure to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast to be the first to get notified when future episodes are released. If you like the show or want to share feedback, please leave a review so we can keep improving and share the word with other leaders in the tech talent space. If you have suggestions for topics we should cover, please feel free to reach out to either myself or Gareth.